Let's do this, everybody. Welcome back to the VPZD show episode. I don't know, what are we, 20 now, VP?
Maybe like 18, 19, something like that.
Something like that. We're doing something different today. We're recording it live via Zoom, and we actually have video. And I've got my hand on a button that clicks between VP and ZD. And that way, I don't have to edit it in post. It's just already done. Could it suck? Absolutely. Is it a disastrously bad idea? 100%. Is VP sexy as hell on camera? Yes, he is.
Well, you know what? I'm impressed you can do this. This is going to put your skills to the test. Having a conversation and pushing the button every time.
You know what? Women have been doing this for millennia, this idea of multitasking, like the baby's over here, the breast is here, they're breastfeeding, and they're doing this and they're doing that. Whereas guys, it's like if they have more than one task, everything falls to hell, right?
I've never been able to do more than one thing in my life. Yeah, never. Never have, never will. I can't control the button.
I will.
It's like walking and chewing gum. Walking and chewing gum.
I'll double down on that and say I'm not even sure I can do one thing right. So today we're going to talk about the gun stuff that's going on, and especially in healthcare. I want to talk about this attack on this clinic in Tulsa. We don't have the answers to this, but it'll be an interesting conversation. I'd love to pick your brain on it. We're going to talk a little bit about Great Resignation and how it's affecting all of us now, the fallout of our COVID pandemic response. We'll probably talk about Ashish Jha and some school stuff that he said, people need an annual COVID shot. We'll talk about monkeypox, because why not? Because we want the clickbait, right, VP?
That's what it's for.
It's like you say monkeypox, suddenly your views triple. And then we'll round it out with a little Amber Heard, Johnny Depp disaster. So
my expertise, that's my core expertise. I want you to know that.
I got
to
say this.
Heard Depp trial.
I've heard many people say VP should stay in his lane about COVID. Z-Dog MD should not talk about guns. Stay in your lane. I'm like, you know what our lane is? Without a doubt, Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. Am I right?
Hey, listen, our lane is trials. So ischemia, sprint, Heard Depp. That's the three big trials. That's our lane. We're in trials.
The sprint trial and the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial, both with confusing outcomes, large sample sizes, and really
and some shitty design.
Exactly. And totally unclear endpoints. All right, let's start.
Let's do this.
Every time we turn on the news, it seems like there's some kind of mass shooting going on. And whether that's perceptual or real, I think it actually is real. There is an increase in this. And some of it, I think, is purely pandemic pent-up rage. We've isolated people. We've taken away mental health services. You can get a gun basically by just showing up and asking for one in many states. And so that's a toxic stew of disgruntled, isolated male, usually, and easy access to weapon that can kill a lot of people at once, and then all the rage and pent up angst, and then you see this. Now, again, this is such a charged topic, but I'll say it hits home. People are like, stay in your lane. It's like, well, okay, first of all, this kind of is our lane because we're doctors, but second of all, it becomes our lane when a disgruntled patient shows up to an orthopedic surgeon's office, shoots and kills two doctors and a receptionist and a patient, and wounds a bunch of other people in a place of medical care, which just happened in Tulsa. I mean, what are your thoughts so far, VP?
A terrible tragedy. I mean, one more thing I'd add is that, you know, I've actually published some papers on gun violence, guns, declining lethality, things like this. One of the points that we made in the paper we published was that since we're better at resuscitation, since we're better at taking care of people who are the victim of gunshot wounds, it actually is masking some of the increased homicides that would have occurred otherwise. And so that was a point we made in a publication about maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago.
Oh.
So, yeah. I mean, this is the toughest question. This is the toughest question, which is obviously nobody wants this to happen. Everybody, I think, wants this avoided and averted. How are you going to get there? And how are you going to get there from where we are right now, which is something that I feel like people don't often acknowledge enough, where the United States is right now, both in terms of the raw number of firearms that are already out there, as well as the culture. So you have the political reality, you have the reality on the streets, and then you have to think about policy solutions. And those policy solutions have to thread the needle between the law, politics, culture, etc. And it is really not so easy, but I'm happy to get into it with you.
Yeah, no, and this is why I think it's important to discuss with you because, again, you've written about this. And I don't, you know, this is exactly the situation where all that nuance, where you know, what I keep rebranding as alt-middle thinking, this idea that, okay, yeah, there are these scientific principles of, you know what, if you didn't have guns, there wouldn't be bullet holes in people. If you didn't have access to guns, you shape a sort of path that people are walking on. It just makes it harder to do a mass killing. You know, you can go in England and have a stabbing, but it's not going to kill, you know, 25 kids.
People.
Right.
Yeah.
And so there's those simple shapings of the environment, sort of systems engineering that happen with guns. But then you have the cultural reality of American culture, which is a very liberty-minded culture. You have these constitutional pieces on right to bear arms for all the controversy around what the founding fathers actually meant and so on.
Right.
The truth is it's there codified in the Constitution. And Americans, you know, there's 3 million Americans or something at last count that for whom this is an existential issue. Like they think guns are the most important thing. So you have a gun-owning population that actually has a liberty versus oppression moral palette that says, you know, the government, if I don't have guns, the government can do anything they want to me. Of course, they don't realize that the government can do anything they want anyways because the government has an army and nuclear weapons and all the other stuff they have. But that feeling of, you know, I need to arm myself and so on is kind of ingrained in this country as well as the sort of hunting culture and so on. But what we have now is this rampant ability for, you know, an 18-year-old on his 18th birthday in Texas to go get an AR-15 and we have no mental health services for that kid. We have a kid who comes from this karmic background of complete abuse and destruction. Mom is purportedly a drug addict and all kinds of stuff going on. All the warning signs were there, ignored or purposely or unintentionally ignored. And now he has access to a weapon that can murder tons of people at once. So, what's your thinking?
Oh boy!
Yeah, I know, right?
Where to get started? I mean, I guess let's maybe put some more facts on the table that we'll all, you know, we can agree on before we can kind of get into the issues. One is that whether we like it or not, estimates range between 400 to 600 million firearms are already out there in circulation in the United States. So I think that's a reality that has to be considered deeply in any policy solution, which is that what can you even do when you have 600 million guns out there? I mean, I'm not, you know, there are things you can do, of course, and I'm going to support anything that you can do that works. But I think you have to acknowledge there's 600 million guns, maybe 400 to 600 million guns in circulation, and that poses a big challenge. I think the next thing is the point you're making, which is that there is a fraction of people in the country, 1 in 100 people, that this is a very important issue to. And they also, politically, the reality is that even the sides that are supporting of sort of, you know, what they call common sense gun reforms, those are, from a grand scheme of things, you know, rather modest, not selling, you know, certain types of weapons, some types of background checks. One of the points you made about red flags, I think people forget about is you always see an incident and then you can ask yourself, was there a red flag? Absolutely. In this case, many red flags. But the question is, if you took everybody who had a red flag event and actually did something about it, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about each year 1 million people have a red flag event and we have to track them, follow them, investigate them, see what they're up to? Are we talking about 2 million people? Are we talking about 5 million people, 10 million people? How many people are hitting those red flags? Because it's like any other policy problem. You don't know who is going to actually do it. You can only know that the flag is there. What sort of resources would it take? What sort of evidence would it take to act upon those red flags? You know, you talk about mental health. People always talk about mental health, but the part that I'm still unsure about what they mean is, you know, it's easy to say mental health contributes. If you were to identify people suffering from mental health problems along this spectrum that predispose one to violence, what are you going to do to them to lower their risk of violence? What evidence suggests that that will actually lower the risk of violence? You know, these are very complex questions. And I think the evidence is quite weak. I mean, one of the reasons the evidence is weak is this has been a place where no one could study it for many years, many decades. Those are some of my preliminary thoughts. I think I'm not a constitutional expert. You know, I think many people read this. I mean, obviously, and I'm so disillusioned with the law, to be honest with you. I really sometimes wonder if do they really have any principles in law, or is it just like people read it and they just decide whatever the hell they want it to mean on any issue in the law, not just guns, but, you know, the Second Amendment calls for the right to bear arms among a well-regulated militia that's been extended by the court over the last 25 years to a personal right to bear arms. I mean, that's been upheld for many, you know, for a long time, and it's even extended into the Heller decision and handguns, you know, but some of the weapons that we have now were probably, they certainly didn't exist when they signed that document, and they may have even been unthinkable to the people who wrote the document, written at a time where you have like a single loading musket. Did they imagine these weapons? Is this what they intended? But then also, I don't know, the way I understand the law is people always say that one school of thought is you need to interpret this the way they intended. But that is, you know, there's no, who says that that's the way to interpret? You could interpret it any way you want to interpret, and other people interpret it differently. It's just that that has become a dominant legal philosophy, this sort of originalism, which itself I think is arbitrary. And sometimes I look at judges and I think they just interpret it, you know, they have decided what they want the policy to be and they interpret it any way you get there. And I honestly, scientists are often the same way. They've decided what they want the policy to be and then they conduct science that reaches that conclusion. So it's, you know, that to me doesn't feel like it's anything more than that. I don't know. Those are scattered thoughts, but and then I'm happy to get into any of this.
So, okay. Yeah, I think this is a great starting point for this discussion because it is so multi-layered. One of the things you pointed out was the legal aspect of it. And I think increasingly listening to you talk about it, I feel like the legal apparatus is an expression of the culture. So if there is a cultural bias towards liberty and gun ownership, and in America that's clear, then that will manifest in laws. Now, then you add in the there's always financial stuff, just like in medicine. You pointed out the parallels between science and law and motivated reasoning and so on, and how we do things. I think you can look at the pharmaceutical industry influence in medical practice and say, you know, how are they different than the NRA? In terms of their monetary influence, their lobbying influence, their influence on the culture, their influence on the expectations of the consumer, and this idea that, you know, I think NRA has set a bar that says any compromise on gun legislation is a slippery slope to an absolute ban on guns, which is unthinkable in that sphere. And so it becomes this very complex web to unravel. And also, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. So, for example, in medicine in particular, because we're biased and we see a lot of times the outcomes of gun-related violence, we cannot put ourselves in the shoes of someone who would want to own a gun, who is actually really into guns and so on. And actually, this was me prior to me actually going to a shooting range with a friend a few years back and firing a handgun and realizing, oh my gosh, like this is... First of all, it's kind of like an amazing sport. Second of all, there's a real quality to firing a weapon that it almost is an addictive quality. And there's a skill component to it. There's all this other stuff. And then there is this feeling like, well, if I'm in a rural part of the country, like where I grew up, and you call 911 and the cops don't show up for, you know, 20 minutes because it's just so far away or they're slow or whatever, how do you defend yourself when other people are potentially are armed? And having a weapon in that case and really knowing how to use it, training, going to the range, et cetera, becomes a very compelling conscious and unconscious kind of motivation. So I have a lot of deep sympathy to gun owners and their concerns around, you know, what might be an erosion of what their perceived rights are in gun ownership. So then how does that relate to, say, something like happened in Australia where the policy was changed almost overnight and there was a gun buyback and so on? So I'll toss it back to you.
You know, okay, great point. But, you know, Australia, people often point to that. I think we have to accept the fact that we are not Australia. I mean, look at the level of obedience Australians had in response to lockdown measures. That obedience does not exist in this country.
That's a great point. Yeah.
You know, they're an obedient people. No offense, Australians, but you're more obedient than Americans. Americans aren't as obedient as you. We wouldn't do that. I don't think that, I mean, you know, it worked there. I don't know if that'll work here.
And in terms of obedience, we may be talking about either trust or belief in government as an entity that you should respect and listen to.
Yes, I mean, you're right. Obedience may sound like a pejorative way to put it, but the optimistic way to put it is they have a shared sense of collective responsibility and that collectivism is strong, perhaps. But, you know, it is what it is. At the end of the day, they are probably far more likely to, you know, allow their guns to be bought back than I think many people in this country.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know the distribution of the 400 to 600 million guns in circulation, but I suspect it's not, you know, two per person. It's got a right-tailed distribution. There's a few people at the end of the distribution with a lot of them, and I suspect the people with a lot of them are the ones least likely to let those return and be bought back. And so I think that that is almost untenable in this country.
Yeah.
I think one of the challenges that they face, the politicians face, is that politicians have positioned themselves on two sides of the issue. One side of the issue is the side you've alluded to, which is that we will do absolutely nothing to curb the sale, manufacture, or use of firearms. And I think that is the NRA position. And a lot of people ally themselves with that position. The other side is talking about, I think, modest or incremental steps. But the challenge I think they face, the deep challenge, is they may end up in a situation where they get a lot of what they want, but the problem may still rage unchecked or may even accelerate. And if they end up in that situation where they've gotten some things and the problem actually gets worse, or the visibility of the problem gets worse, they're going to be in a bad situation, because the other side is going to say, look, you got all the things you wanted and look what you've gotten for it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the challenge with measures that are very much on the margin or very sort of modest, you know, just from a policy standpoint. And then your last point about that firearm into home and defending, I mean, there's a lot of data on this question, which is like, are you actually safer by having one in your house? And it accepts the reality. I mean, you talked about the person who's training and knows how to use it and all this stuff and keeps it in a safe or whatever, et cetera. But the reality is that that might not be true for everybody who owns it. And I think the evidence, which is, I think, very limited, I mean, in terms of methodologically limited, it does suggest that you may be even worse off by having it in your house, like that somebody in your house, like a child, will get a hold of it and much more likely to shoot themselves accidentally than you are to stop the burglar, et cetera. You know, But again, you know, this is not very high level evidence. These are confounded by the types of people who are buying this and the types of environments they're in, et cetera. I have to say that I think it's, you know, this is my last thought on this and I'll turn it back to you. It's this: there are some issues in biomedicine and public health that become issues of virtue. And by virtue issues, I mean that different people in different tribes and different political parties believe there is a right answer. And I do think there are people on the far left who believe that if we lived in a society free of all guns, that's a much more virtuous place to be than the society we're living in now. And I think there are people on the right who believe if we live in a society that is free of guns, that is a very dangerous place where one day they could institute indefinite lockdowns or something like that, and I'll have no way to deter that. And I think maybe we even have to acknowledge that some places that didn't institute prolonged lockdowns did so because they were fearful of an armed populace. I mean, who knows? Why, you know, that's part of the culture. Why didn't they do it in some states? They knew they couldn't even do it. I mean, so is it a deterrent effect against government? I don't know the answer to the question. I mean, it's a question that cannot be answered by data. There are these two extremes, and they have the strong view, and both of that view is wedded to virtue. I mean, it's a different sense of virtue. One is a virtue where we all live in, you know, peace without these weapons, and the other is a virtue of the virtue of sort of self-protection. And when you have such a setting, I think that the science that's generated in that setting is often very, very difficult to do and to interpret and to be clear about, very difficult to draw causality. I worry that people are so wedded to their policy conclusion that they let themselves be misled by science. I mean, and the same is true for, you know, an example that will be much less triggering to people, no pun intended, is, I think, cloth masking kids. Some people believe it and some people don't believe it. And, you know, do I believe any of these retrospective observational studies that prove it works or doesn't? Not really, because I know that they don't want it and they're not going to, the study's going to not find, you know what I mean? So when you do these kinds of evidence generation in a space that is so polarized and so synonymous with virtue, what you're left with is often very low credibility evidence that doesn't deal with some of these thorny issues. I think the one thing that, you know, that maybe more people could agree upon is the need to actually do empirical studies of this phenomenon and what might ameliorate the problem free of bias and as much as that's possible.
Oh, okay. Okay, man, everything. Okay. All the things you just said are so crucial to understanding this problem, because this idea of motivated reasoning, I think, imagine this situation. You're the NRA, right? And you're tasked with protecting gun rights in the United States, and also protecting probably the profits of people who help fund you, like the gun manufacturers and so on. And you're being told, listen, we need to study the gun issue. Scientists and biomedical people need to study this. Epidemiologists need to study this and try to figure out what are actually solutions that work? What kind of gun restrictions help? What don't help with this and that? But in the NRA's mind, they already know the power of motivated reasoning. They know that many right. people in the biomedical community skew more liberal. They're going to be in that virtuous category, in the virtue category of no guns is better, as opposed to an armed populace is better. And they're going to skew their study or their bias or their conclusions in a way that is not ever going to be objective. And so this idea of being able to study it objectively to them is a non-starter. So they just say, don't study it at all. You can't use CDC money. You can't use public, you know, and that kind of thing. And I suspect, just with my limited understanding of it, that maybe that's a component of it. So in this situation where we have a country that's now 200 and some odd years into the grand experiment of liberty and a Second Amendment a gun thing and the gun culture, and like you said, the tail end of the group that are this is a existential issue for them. We're now in a situation where there's no magic answer. It's difficult to study. We have outcomes that nobody's happy with currently. Like, I don't think gun rights people are happy with mass shootings. I don't think anti-gun people are happy with the school shootings or any shootings. And so we're in a very tough situation. So I don't know the best way forward, but I think that kind of disentangling some of the virtue and having some introspection to be able to say, okay, what's my moral palette say? And then what is actually a way we could study this objectively might be a start.
It's well put. And I guess I have to say that I think this is a perennial debate, which is how much can you be the researcher and how much can you be the advocate? And people always say, I can be both. But the truth is, the more you are one, the harder it is for people to take you credible as the other. And there is that tension. And I know people want to wish that tension weren't there. And the net result is, I think exactly as you say, that that side that favors gun rights, they do view the entire academy as captured by the opposite philosophical point of view, and that they would be unwilling to trust any of those results. And as a net result, I think they've lobbied very hard and they've been very successful. I mean, their success is really remarkable that they have. I mean, on many of these issues, it appears that, you know, when you poll the majority of Americans, they want X. And yet that's not what happens because the vocal minority has overpowered the majority on a lot of these issues. And they view it that any research is only going to be unfavorable to us because maybe they don't see it as I would say it, that they believe that they don't understand about analytical flexibility and things like this. But they, I think they have an intuitive sense of what might generate. What I would suggest is one way to move forward is to create some system where everybody who is a scientist, those of us who still remain willing to look at data and come to different conclusions, that we create a system where there are some checks and balances where we could actually study a topic without, you know, knowing what the answer will be preordained. I think it has to be. I mean, otherwise, you know, we can move to one part of this, which is the mental health part. I don't think anyone knows. You know, let's just say I give you, I don't know, $500 billion. And then I said, okay, the only thing you can spend your money on is mental health. And I want you to do things for mental health that will curb gun violence like this. How are you going to deploy that money? I think the truth is that you don't have much idea what you would do to deploy that money. You might have some vague senses that you'd want to target adolescent boys between the ages of, you know, 15 and 30 or something. You know, those sort of the most, you know, the high risk age group for committing the crime.
Mm-hmm.
How will you identify them? And I think the moment you start to try to, like, how will you identify the group of people you want to, you know, put resources behind? The first challenge you'll find is that the denominator will be, I think, vast. I suspect it'll be vast. It'll be millions and millions. The vast majority of those millions are never going to pick up a gun and kill somebody, right? That's just the nature of it. But within that pile of millions and millions, there are the high risk, you know, the high risk threats. What are you going to do to them to improve their mental health? What, you know, are you know, and I think people are very quick to assume that, oh, if I just give somebody some counseling or some Prozac, or, you know, it's going to make it all better, you know. But this is really a naive view of, I think, psychiatry, which is that it's not always so easy to improve upon some of these things.
Yeah, okay, okay. A couple things I just want to interject, yeah, because, you know, I had psychologist Rachel Zofness on the show, and she was talking about school shootings and how to screen and so on, and the warning signs and so on. And like you say, I think that the difficulty with the approach, because it's a common sense approach, but the outcomes may not be common sense. Millions of people may fall into that screen. You're now making educators and law enforcement even more overwhelmed. And the question is, what do you do to intervene? And your point about this is not simply a receptor, a serotonin deficiency or something like that. Yes. This is the karmic, intergenerational, traumatic result of, and when I say karma, I'm not trying to be metaphysical. I'm saying cause and effect. A person grows up in a broken household where there's abuse, where there's maybe a single parent, there's all this other stuff going on. They're then in a school situation like this kid in Texas who, you know, he's bullied for his stuttering, he's bullied for his speech impediment, so on. Who knows whether that was an epiphenomenon of him being already a weird kid versus weird meaning not fitting the social norms, meaning maybe there was some evidence of antisocial behavior already. I mean, who knows, right? You can't tell. It's so incredibly complex. It's interwoven into the fabric of reality in a way that you can't disentangle it in the form of a pill or a simple counseling intervention. And how do you stop it? So, well, you can engineer systems so that it's harder for a kid like that to do a lot of harm. So that may be then talking about the gun issue. You from the other side of the gun angle, where people are like, no, we want our guns. Okay, so we want to engineer schools so that it's harder for a kid to show up in a school and shoot things. Okay, I mean, again, who knows what the answer is? You'd have to actually study it in a dispassionate, non-motivated way, which, again, difficult to do, right?
I mean, and back to that kid. I mean, I'm gonna come to the gun part, but the mental health part. Just one more thought on it. Like, let's just say you could probably build more consensus on the mental health side. So you identify all these vulnerable kids. By the way, the number of kids that fit that bill who've been bullied, who are single parent homes, who are from lower socioeconomic status. We're talking millions.
It's like millions of kids. Yeah,
millions. So that's the first challenge you face. Then you do something to them. You counsel them. You treat them. You meet their needs. Something like that. One worry is that the more you talk about shooting and violence and things like that, there's a real worry, I think, you could even accelerate a problem. I mean, in the history of biomedicine, people have done interventions. For instance, this is a separate incident, but they took teenage girls in Australia many years ago. They gave them a baby doll that would simulate what it's like to be a teen parent, and the baby doll will cry and wake you up at night, and it's a torture to have this baby doll around. And what it did was it led to an increase in teen pregnancy. You know, it's thought to be, dissuade people.
So this is like a saliency effect. So people will, and related to this is like, say, advertising. You know that the advertisements are bullshit. You know that pharma buying you lunch or whatever is a total play to try to get you to do something. You know that on a conscious level. On an unconscious level, it normalizes something. It biases you in a way that's subtle. And it's the same thing with, like you said, with the doll that, like, trying to scare you straight. It actually somehow subtly normalizes that having a kid at that age is okay or normal or whatever. And these are the subtleties that actually we don't, you know, you think common sense would say otherwise, but it's never as simple as that, especially with human beings. And it's the same, like, if you think about screening for prostate cancer, or the show we did with Rita Redberg, all this kind of screening stuff. What's the downside? Well, there's actually harm that can happen from that mm-hmm. isn't obvious. And I think it's the same with what you're saying.
Right. Yes. And now the harder part is the guns part, because, you know, what are the kind of rules, restrictions, regulations, buying ages, background checks, weapons you can sell, weapons you can't sell? Many people have many thoughts on these things. And I guess, you know, I mean, I have an intuition too, but, you know, my intuition is not the same as data. And so I'll keep my intuition myself. I'll just talk about, you know, one of the things people always say, which I think is just sort of a naive way of thinking, is they say, if we had this rule in place, this wouldn't have happened. Okay? You know, if he couldn't get this gun, this wouldn't have happened. But the challenge I see with that kind of thinking is the counterfactual is, well, maybe they, instead of not doing it at all, they would have found a different avenue of getting a weapon. So they may not have used this weapon, they'd use that weapon. They may not have killed X, they'll kill X minus 5. You know, maybe there's some things there. But that's also, this is sort of an anecdote. I mean, this is really sort of a very low level of evidence. This is sort of anecdotal, counterfactual thinking, which is really sort of the same as an imagination. I mean, you really need sort of broad scale population level evidence. One of the challenges in this debate is I mean, I have to be honest. This shooting broke me. I mean, I called you and I told you about it. I mean, I was emotionally devastated.
It was truly one of the most affecting things I've seen in the news in recent memory. I mean, it was horrible.
Yeah, it broke my spirit. And I remember thinking how broken I felt. And then the more I learned about the inadequacy of the response and sitting out there.
Angry.
And I wrote a whole thing on duty, which I think some people realize what I was really talking about. And I think duty, and part of you always feels like this is sort of a culture in decline, a culture that's just killing itself and, unable to use science to advance. The pandemic response was evidence of a culture in decline. Our wealth inequality is evidence of culture in decline. School shootings are a culture in decline. This is the beginning of the end of this civilization. It feels like, to some people, sort of an existential crisis.
You know, I think people forget that apocalypse looks different ways. Like, apocalypse may not be the meltdown and nuclear war that we always imagine in growing up in the Cold War. Apocalypse may simply be that San Francisco starts to look more like Mogadishu with each passing generation, you know? It's an insidious, slow decline.
Yeah, that's really well put. That's very well put. And, we don't know what society looks like in decline in modernity. We know what it looks like in antiquity. What does it look like in modernity? But just to finish the thought on the guns and the gun legislation is, I think it's very difficult. I mean, I know people wish that, I know people say with confidence they know what would happen if we were to implement this policy or that policy. If only we could get 60 senators or 50 senators or break the filibuster, we could make a difference. I think it's very difficult to know what you will get. The society may be declining faster than these sort of efforts can help. The efforts that you need to do might need to be much bigger and bolder than what is currently on the table. You might need to address this in a different space. You might need to also address this in other places, such as fundamental challenges with wealth inequality, income inequality, which I think are huge drivers of dissatisfaction. And, giving people purpose in life and giving people something for everybody to strive for, things like mandatory service or encouraged national service or things like, ways to sort of diffuse this time bomb. Anyways, I guess I'm rambling, but my point is that I just don't know. I don't know, and I would be hesitant to say with certainty what specific policy measures will accomplish. I think the people who speak very definitively in this space are overplaying their hand. I think the last thing you want to do is overplay your hand, just like I thought with COVID-19. When you make policy, you need to be very, very clear that it might not do what you think it does, and you need to have some systems in place to detect that. And if you don't, you will forfeit the credibility of the population. And I think we saw that many, many times with COVID-19. This is a very tough space. And I think, those are my thoughts.
You were saying you were rambling at one point. No, it's not rambling. Mm-hmm. What it is you're shooting bullets around.
Don't use that analogy.
Oh, sorry.
You're throwing darts.
You're bouncing electrons off the target that you want to visualize. It's kind of like an indirect way of saying, what's the fundamental problem? And I'm gonna, again, this is intuition and a little bit of experience, so there's no data here, but I think that if we actually focused learning, teaching, growing humans on multiple axes, so psychologically growing them, socially growing them, technologically growing them, and spiritually, meaning they wake up, they're more and more in touch with the present moment, they're more and more in touch with what they actually are and what they aren't, which is a bundle of thoughts and emotions and body and all this. When that happens, society as an epiphenomenon of the individual transforms. And I think part of the reason, and I'm very much a believer in what you said, with all these policy masturbations and things that we talk about, if we just did this, if we just did that, if we just did this, it's almost like in medicine where we go, if we just gave a statin, if we just did the bypass surgery, if we just did this, it would solve the problem. Whereas the root rot has not been addressed, which is this narcissistic, egoic, societal conditioning that we must acquire goods and we must be consumers, we must do all this stuff, and that we're somehow separate from everything that is. I think ultimately that's the core delusion that is driving the everything all the stuff we see. And I also love that you compare this to our COVID-19 response. It's the same thing. You have a society in decline, and then you have this apparatus that is trying to steer policy. But in reality, you're dealing with a society in decline. And I think that's why you see differences in countries. It's not so much the policies cause the differences. It's the policies are epiphenomenons of the culture and the general societal integrity to begin with.
I think that's an astute point. And I guess by comparison, the only point of comparison I mean is that nobody wanted anyone to die of COVID-19, and nobody wants anyone to die, I think, of gun violence. I think that's something that every person will agree. They don't want innocent people to die from these problems. But the question, of course, always is, given where you are now, what can you do to ameliorate it going forward? And the answer is always, for very complex social dynamic problems, is you need careful, dispassionate science that doesn't know what it's going to find. Because it could be that the best thing you think of is the thing that doesn't work, and the thing you think is least promising might actually have the biggest return. I think that's one. And it's very hard to do that in this space. And I can only think of a couple spaces even harder to do it than this one, but this is one of the hardest. I think you need to have less certainty. And I guess, to me, I do find it off-putting when people tell me things that they are like so confident will do the trick, especially lay people who haven't really spent a lot of time delving into it, because I don't know. It's funny. In many ways in life, we don't have arrogance. For instance, Z, if I sent you to the garage and I said, make me a MacBook Pro.
You'd get a top of the line product, Vinay. Come on.
I'd get some cardboard with some stickies on it.
That's racist. I don't know why, but I'm going to accuse you of racism there. Okay.
Well, I'm sure you can help me set up my internet, but no.
What are you saying? Are you saying because I'm Indian, I do the IT? Come on.
But I guess it's interesting that when it comes to like building a laptop, you and I would be everyone would be the first to admit, oh man, I don't know how to build a laptop. That's hard. It's hard to build a laptop. But when people want to solve like very complex societal problems, they act like they know the answer. I was like, come on, dude. I was like, it's the same thing. It's like it's actually more complex than a laptop probably to solve this problem.
Easily. And I think that's where you get into this Dunning-Kruger idea. A little bit about something, but you're passionate about it. Therefore, you overestimate your knowledge. There's this concept called the explanatory gap, I believe. And it was looked at when you try to ask somebody, okay, so tell me how a zipper works exactly. Or can you explain in detail exactly how a toilet works? And they'll come up confidently and say, oh, sure, I can do that. And then as they start to write, they go, how does a zipper work exactly? and the toilet, what does that work? So this idea that we overestimate our knowledge and there's this explanatory gap, in these things, I think there's a sense of control because we're outraged morally. Then we go, well, you know what? I know the answer. And by knowing the answer, there's a sense of certainty and control. And that's why, like you said, when people project that certainty, you should immediately recoil in distrust. You know what's interesting? Then they'll say, well, but you and Vinay are so certain that our pandemic response was a shit show and so on, and that we should. No. What we're saying is, here are all the reasons that this has been an inadequate understanding. We're agnostic to what the actual answer is, but we are telling you that the way we've looked about the epistemic disaster of how to even acquire the knowledge is what we're pointing out.
Yeah, and just to push on that a little bit, I think the pandemic response is even to some degree an easier topic to talk about. And it's easier because it is abundantly clear to anybody that there were simple questions that could easily have been answered, which is, children between the ages of 2 and 5 are advised by the World Health Organization not to wear a cloth mask, but the CDC to wear a cloth mask. It seems like an easy place where you would take many such children and randomize them in clusters to one or the other, and you will know the answer in 1 month. That's very simple. That's actually a simple question. And the fact they didn't do it speaks to gross incompetence, tribalism, groupthink, and all the sort of failures. That is a failure to generate evidence in a time of crisis. And people like myself, who naively thought this was only going to last for 2 months, ergo, you don't have to worry about evidence generation, now find ourselves in year 3 when Alameda County just re-implemented mask mandates with no credible data after vaccinate. Okay, so this is why we talk about
cloth mask mandate. Easier, right.
Yeah, right. No, of course. Yeah, when you go mask mandate, you got to go big. You got to go for that That porous cloth. All right. Well, I mean, I don't know. We could talk about this a long time, but I guess I'll give you my closing thoughts, and I'll take on this guns issue, which I think is so tough. I mean, I guess the only thing I'd say is, you know, I was totally devastated, especially with the school. And I still am devastated, and I have difficulty even listening to media on the topic and thinking about the topic. And there are very few topics that devastate me so hard that I can't even sort of even try to avoid.
Yeah, I'm avoidant of it. Like, it gives me trauma. Yeah. Like, I can't function reading these stories.
Yeah, I found myself in my car and, you know, just devastated. And anyway, and so I would absolutely, you know, do whatever it takes to solve the problem. And I think that if you really put a gun to my head and put me in charge, I think I would really think about mechanisms where we could try things and really have an honest way of knowing if they are working or not, simultaneously while studying the phenomenon as freely as possible, and as unbiased as possible. And if that means that, you know, maybe to make people happy about the quality of the research, if you have to literally draft people to do this research who didn't want to do this research, you know what I mean? Like, you know, what is what, you know, we have to sort of think of ways that we can really sate everybody here, that we're pulling in scientists who really don't feel strongly about this issue. And maybe when you submit your NIH grant, you consent by submitting the grant that 1% of you could be drafted into projects of public importance. This is one, and there are many other projects of public importance. And so you get somebody, he studies the mTOR pathway, for instance.
Right.
And then he finds out, is my grant funded or not? No, but you have been drafted into working on this issue, and you're entering this issue without a strong, you know, presumably because these are people who didn't choose to do that issue with their life. And you pull him in. But what does he have? He knows how to run experiments. He knows how to think about science. He presumably understands data. And maybe you get some consultants who do have content-specific expertise. And then you get some unbiased methodologists. And you try to work on this. And I think that would be what a society not in decline does. Admitting that, you know, it's a complex policy problem. Simple solutions may not be adequate. We need a lot more information. We need to make sure what we're doing is right. And we need to do it sort of incrementally. And we got to work at it. And if we're, and I mean, right now, what is the status quo? Literally no progress in any direction as everything is paralyzed. That's, I think, unacceptable. That's part of a society in decline.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I want to wrap the gun issue back just quickly with the healthcare violence issue. A society in decline does what we see now, which is you have patients that are abusing staff. And some of that is a function of the increasingly abusive nature of our healthcare system towards patients. The fact that we financially assault patients with surprise billing, the fact that we do things to people instead of for them because that's how we're trained and conditioned. We don't do it intentionally. And now you have this epiphenomenon of the cultural okayness to strike a nurse or to shoot a physician, it seems. So it's interesting. I think there's some data a while back that said nurses are more likely to be assaulted, but doctors are more likely to be killed. And I think that's because with physicians, the patient, like, who knows what was going on in this Oklahoma case, but it appeared this patient was angry at the pain post-op from a spine surgery that who knows, you know, what the details are. And then consciously went, bought a weapon that day and targeted the physician who did his surgery to kill this physician, and then killed the patient, killed himself. And that's a very direct kind of expression of dissatisfaction with a healthcare system that is so clearly apocalyptically dysfunctional. And yet we have laws that we have systemic responses to it that are so woefully inadequate. In many states, it's not even, you know, it's like a misdemeanor or something to assault a healthcare professional. Many administrations will tell nurses and stuff, it's not worth pursuing this. You know, sure, you were pregnant and this patient kicked you intentionally in the stomach in their right mind. But you know what? It's going to mess up our patient satisfaction scores, or it's going to mess up the perception that we're militarizing the hospital with security and so on. And so there is this, again, cultural epiphenomenon of the decay of the culture. We sound like conservatives in a way, don't we? Who talk about decay of culture. But I think it's a real phenomenon that—
There's truth in all points of view.
Exactly, you know? Right. And so that conservative angle of, you know what, there are these sort of moral foundations, a sort of sanctity versus degradation that then almost epigenetically presents as these phenomenon that we see. And I think there's definitely a kernel of truth, if not more, in that.
On this healthcare thing, I'd say— Nobody who works in healthcare should ever be assaulted, berated, demeaned. No one should certainly be shot. These are unacceptable. No matter the quality of the service provided is unacceptable. There is a remedy for dissatisfaction. It's the courts. And actually, the courts are quite favorable often to malpractice litigation, et cetera, or other litigation. So that's the remedy. It's not violence. And I think we need to do lots of things so that people are safe, feel safe, and are safe. Things that actually work, not just things that are token. You know, I saw that somebody was like, oh, we should install some sort of metal detector at the door or something like that. I mean, I don't know if that's going to do the trick, to be honest with you. Will somebody bring sort of a 3D printed plastic gun or something? You know, I mean, and it's going to be a huge burden. Now everyone's going to wait in line for 2 hours to get into the hospital. You know, I don't know if that's the answer.
Yeah.
We could study it, et cetera. But that's one thing. The second thing is medicine also has part of the social contract. And that's, we should also discuss. And that social contract is, as you say, we have a duty not to financially assault people, but we are swallowing 20% of GDP and climbing, and we're not delivering for that. We have a duty to offer services and surgeries that actually do work on average, and yet we have many things, particularly around pain, that we offer that we don't really know. Spine surgery, of course, an extremely controversial area with very low quality evidence suggesting that it works or not works. Some have been contradicted. Lack of ongoing sham-controlled studies, etc. I mean, it's a weak evidence space. We have to be honest about that. What that means is that many people will undergo it and still feel very dissatisfied. And other parts of medicine that are based on low-quality evidence. And then the final thing is we have to be careful not to abuse our power, like depriving people of visitation around dying in COVID times, which was an abuse of power. Both sides of the social contract need to be honored more. But certainly, I certainly am strongly opposed to, you know, any violence on a physician. It's terrible.
Yeah, and nurses,
unacceptable.
And nurses are the ones who email me the most because they're the biggest victims of random assaults, and not random, but assaults in healthcare. And you know what? Many nurses tell me, you know, they work in some who work in prison systems say they've never felt safer than working in a prison system with a population of antisocial criminals than in a regular hospital where they got no support felt unsafe and so on. And I believe it. So okay, to happier and more jovial topics. Ashish Jha, our fellow brown person in power in the White House, you had some thoughts on some recent stuff with him, yeah?
Yeah, so I call balls and strikes, okay? I call balls and strikes. That's all I'm in the business of. You know what? You know, you do a good job, you're going to get my praise, and you make mistakes, you're going to get my condemnation. And so what happened was there's a little clip that's going viral, and the clip is this. As Ashish Jha is finishing his press conference, and he's the White House COVID czar now. He used to be a tweeter. He used to be on Twitter. He's a faculty member who did some work in global health and policy, and he tweeted a lot about COVID, and his tweets went viral, and that caught the attention of the White House. I mean, we have to be honest. He has that job because he was on Twitter. If he wasn't on Twitter, he wouldn't have that job. They did somebody else. Okay, that's the reality. That's life. He's on the stage, and they ask him, Dr. Jha, does the Biden administration commit to have 100% of schools open in person in the fall? And somebody interrupts and says, you know what, we're done here. We'll take the next question. And he whisked off stage. And of course, people are pissed because that's a really important issue to people. In fact, it might be a key voting issue this fall. And the answer was easy. Yes, we are committed. Yes, we are committed to that. Yes, yes. They have to be in school, in person. Yes, that's the easy answer. He could have just said yes, but he didn't comment. Then on social media, people were mocking him for that shitty response, which, you know, to some degree he maybe had coming, but also he was in a rush, so it's fair. I mean, it's something in between. But then one person said, well, this is very unfair because Ashish Jha has always been a vocal proponent for schools. And I was like, no, I'm sorry. I'm going to call bullshit on that because that is where you're telling bullshit. Ashish Jha, like a lot of people, are clever politicians, and he never really took a strong stance. He always said schools before bars, okay? But he didn't say schools. You know what I said? I said, you want to open bars or close bars? I could care less, but that school better be open. That was my standpoint. But if you say schools before bars, you know, it's bringing these two things together. The next point, what should it take to open schools? Ashish Jha was very vocal in 2020 that if there is high rates of community transmission, it's unsafe to open schools. And he had some number that was a make-believe number. There was never any evidence to support that claim. That was just patently not true. Even at those rates of transmission, schools should have been open. And he created this rule because it makes him look like, this is true for so many people. So many people who really don't want to make a courageous stance, they create some bullshit rule where they're always going to say they were right. Oh, I was 0-4 opening schools as long as you would do it safely. And what does safely mean? Well, you have to install a $100,000 HEPA filter in the school, then you can open schools. But of course, they weren't going to do that. So what's the choice? The reality, should we open or not open? And courage is to say we should do what Sweden did or Switzerland did 6 weeks into the pandemic, which is reopen. It don't matter. Those things are not so important. It's much more important that they're in school. He didn't say that. He wasn't a vocal proponent of opening schools. He played it politically, center of the road, created sort of impossible to meet standards to reopen schools, and schools didn't open. That's one. And two, the reason people are asking the Biden administration is that we have to be honest, it was the blue places that kept them closed and not the red places. The red places, DeSantis was right. Is he right about everything? No. But was he right about schools? Absolutely. And who was wrong? Gavin Newsom was wrong. You know, we got to be honest. Got to be honest. The liberals totally blew it. They blew the schools issue. And so for somebody to tell me that Ashish Jha was always pro-school, that's not true. He created impossible standards for it to reopen. He never was as forceful as he ought to have been. He played it like a politician plays it, taking some weasel middle of the ground answer. But the one thing he didn't count on was on this one issue, the pendulum has swung so hard that if you weren't vigorously pro-school, you were on the wrong side of that issue. And so that's the bottom line.
Man. Yeah, I got nothing to add to that. I think when you look back with the retrospectoscope, the closing of schools, and people will still say, well, no, we just didn't know enough and so on. No. We started to know enough really quick. And the harm that's been done is like an intergenerational trauma that's going to ripple out. You're talking about the decline of society. Again, I don't want to get too...
And it will contribute to the first problem. It'll contribute to the first problem.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't think that pandemic isolation and all the bullshit that happened didn't contribute to all the wave of shit we're seeing now. I mean, we saw it before the pandemic, but it's all this pent-up isolation and detachment and so on. I mean, I know many friends, in fact, who've gone off the rails during pandemic in terms of mental health and so on, because we're social creatures and you've disrupted it. Now, some of it is inevitable disruption of a pandemic. Sure, that's fine. But a lot of it is self-inflicted wounds of policies that just don't make sense. Like this Alameda bringing masking back.
Oh, God.
Look, so Omicron... Dumb. You look at the data now, it's everywhere. It's highly contagious. The virus has evolved to a point where it is absolutely everywhere. Putting a piece of black cloth on your face is not going to do anything except for make some people who are poorly informed feel better about it. Even in the Bay Area.
Maybe make me look better, but, but you know, I got to say one thing about this schools. It's not just in the retrospectoscope. I wasn't a school policy scholar. Okay, but I'm a policy person, and I just read some shit in the summer of 2020, and I quickly figured out that they should be reopened. And you know who else figured it out? Switzerland, Norway, Spain, the United Kingdom. You know who didn't? And you know who else figured it out? The governor of Florida. Who didn't figure it out? New York City, Washington, D.C., San Francisco. This doesn't make any sense. It's not a retrospect thing. It's some people were so... And the crux of it, I think, is that it's all about that Trump.
Yeah, Trump. Trump it's said all about he wanted Trump. It.
Yeah, I know. They're all Trump. And they hate Trump more than they love kids. And they just have no compass. I mean, Z, I think the reality is most people, for most of the things they believe, they have no idea why they hold those views. They haven't really interrogated it. They just believe things that their tribe believes. It's dangerous. I mean... I don't know.
I mean, who was it? Socrates? I don't know who said an unexamined life is not worth living. I mean, you really do have to investigate your own. And look, we all have our blind spots because a lot of times it's the very personality aspect or belief structure that is the lens through which we see the world, and therefore we're blind to it. It's like looking through the looking. And so that's why it's important when someone actually criticizes you. I think it's important to look back and go, okay, there's a lot of noise in that. A lot of it's ad hominem, a lot of it's hate, a lot of it's bias, whatever. But then some of it, there's a kernel of truth there. What is that? Let me reflect on that. Okay, I can see that piece. It's not going to change my mind, but it is going to make me investigate a little bit more how I'm seeing things. And I don't think a lot of us do that well at all, and certainly not the people who made the policies to keep schools closed. And then you have all the vested interests that come in and that they get something out of keeping schools closed. And, you know, it's so much harm. And you're right, it's not a pure retrospective scope thing. But what I'm saying is, looking at it in retrospect, whoever was prospectively saying that was actually correct. I mean, this is, it's clear, right? So, Ash, now what about this annual COVID shot they're talking about now? Again, I feel like, and this is just, oh, shoot, wait.
You got to cut back
to
you.
Yeah, I got to cut back to me. See, I'm losing it. By the way, you know, bald people do not look good with AirPods in. Can you see that? It looks like I've got a couple cigarettes hanging out of my head.
People don't look good with AirPods in. People, they don't look good.
I like that you've normalized baldness by saying, you know, we're all people, even if you're bald.
We're all people.
It's okay. We're
You know
people.
What I got to say? These AirPods are stupid. I mean, they are the worst. I don't know why people like them. I was in an airplane and, you know, I think I reached for something and I bumped my ear and it like popped out, but took two bounces. You know how it took me like 45 minutes to go find that damn AirPod stuck under someone's seat. I mean, this is such a stupid invention.
But you already told me the reason for that, which is your mom used to punish you by pulling on your ears.
Yeah, by pulling my ear. But no, it fell out of the ear she didn't pull, dude. It fell out of the good ear.
It fell out of the control ear.
The control ear, yeah. The ear that's harder to reach. You know, the driver can get one ear, can't get the other ear, right ear. Yeah, it fell out of the good ear.
Did your mom ever do the thing where she took off her chuppel, her slipper, and threw it at you?
And threatened.
Yeah.
Threatened to, you know, like how they threw it at George W. Bush.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah. No, my mom would let it loose, though. She would just throw, I would get hit in the face with a slipper. It's apparently, it's common in Mexican culture too. They call it la chancla, like the slipper or whatever, and it'll come flying. There was a real funny YouTube video. Anyways, so back to what were we talking about? AirPods, looking like a douche. Annual COVID. annual COVID shot. So I got to say this one thing. I feel like we're fetishizing repeated vaccination without data as some sort of control fetish. And the truth is, you get your primary series, plus or minus the booster if you're eligible for that and you need that. Great, wonderful. Continuing to flog the vaccine pony when immunity is going to develop in other ways anyways, it seems a little bit insane. And yet we're requiring these college students to boost, and they're emailing me saying, I almost want to drop out of Stanford or UCLA or these top California schools because they're forcing me to do this. And I actually have principles that I actually like science, and there's no data that this is going to help me or really reduce transmission to others. And yet they're forcing me to do this to myself for no good reason. So back to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's another example of why we say COVID policy went off the rails, which is that coercion is a massive power. And coercing a personal medical intervention on somebody is a huge power. And I am not saying it should never be used, but if it is to be used, it has to be used when it's used appropriately, with the right checks and balances, under the right conditions. And forcing someone to get the third dose of a vaccine that doesn't halt transmission and may or may not even further their risk of severe disease, as in the case of a 20-year-old boy in college, is an abuse of coercion. I mean, there's no doubt about that. That's an abuse, and will historically look like a grave error and will rot the trust in public health and lead to the further death spiral of society. I hate to say it. Yeah. What they're talking about now is a yearly COVID shot. And they're going to be having an advisory committee to discuss this. And I've got nothing against COVID shots that prove themselves. And the question is, what will it mean to prove a yearly COVID shot? What they are talking about is a regulatory pathway where each summer, the FDA says, here are the three strains we think are going to be a problem in the fall. We don't know they're going to be a problem in the fall, but we think these are the three strains. And if you, drug company, make an antibody, if you make a vaccine that develops antibodies that hit these three strains with a certain amount of antibody, we will give you approval to vaccinate that fall. What I want them to say is that if you, drug company, run a randomized controlled trial of people and show a reduction in severe disease or hospitalization, we will give you approval to vaccinate people with that. And you might say, well, how can they do that trial because the season hasn't started yet? Say, just go to the Southern Hemisphere, my friend, and run it there. And if you run it in Australia, New Zealand, you know, and then you bring it back up here, I'm happy to accept those results, you know? Okay, this is the dilemma. The FDA wants to just have them get the approval based on hitting the target, and I want to see clinical data. I think the FDA is going to set the standard dangerously low if they push this through. It's going to be dangerously low because one of those sequences, you know, why do we have myocarditis? I think, you know, it has been very poorly explicated. There is some FDA documents about this Novavax where they suspect it might be that the spike epitopes have a homology to some cardiac epitopes, so that antibody also binds the heart. We don't know exactly. It is incredibly, not incredibly, it is possible that you will change the sequence in that mRNA vaccine and you will get less myocarditis. But it's also possible you will get more and a lot more. You don't know what you're going to get. And so if you don't do any controlled clinical trials beyond looking at antibody levels, you may be missing massive safety signals. You also don't even know you're benefiting people who already have, you know, who are young and healthy, et cetera. So I think this is an important moment in regulatory history where either we're going to have a reasonable and high standard for approving vaccine after vaccine in perpetuity, or we're going to have a low standard. And what I worry even more is once they approve it, you know, hospitals are going to mandate it because people are so brain dead that everything that's EUA authorized has to be mandated. They don't understand. Some things can be a choice. You don't have to take it. It's okay. We don't have to force everyone. It's immediately from EUA to mandate. It goes hand in hand. That's also a feature of a broken society incapable of splitting the difference or having some nuance.
Yep. There's no, you know, I actually, and we've talked about this before. I feel like what has happened is what Ian McGilchrist points out in his book, Master and His Emissary, about the split between left brain and right brain being holistic, relational, emotional, connected, seeing the web of complexity and seeing a thing in its context. And it has its emissary, which is the left brain, which can drill down, break a thing into its parts, analyze the parts. And so it's a good servant of the right brain. What happens, though, is because the left brain has the capacity to speak, whereas the right doesn't. The right's the silent master until the left realizes, I'm the only one who can communicate with the world. And so his argument in the book is that societies progress from a right-brained, artistic, holistic culture to a left-brained, bureaucratic shit show of reductionism, where you think that you take apart, you go, well, if vaccine makes antibody, antibody means safe, mandate it because then everyone will be safe. Okay, that's left-brain thinking. Right. And so you have now a bureaucratic technocracy that reduces human beings to these little widgets, and that's the ascendancy of the emissary instead of the actual duality of having this relational brain that's connected and has this servant of the left brain. Now the servant's become overthrown the master and is created. It's like, I don't know if you ever saw Fantasia, but when Mickey Mouse and the wizard, Mickey Mouse is the wizard's apprentice. The wizard is there. He's like a magician. He's the master. And he goes away and leaves the servant to clean up. The servant finds the wand and it's like, wait, I can do magic. And it becomes a complete shit show of chaos until the wizard comes back. And I think that's what's happening in the broader culture, honestly.
That's really interesting.
It's also entirely non-evidence-based.
No, I mean, I don't know. Some of these sort of like philosophical frameworks for how to think about culture are inherently, you know, not subject to the rules of evidence. They're so broad, but they are important to really think about where we are. And, you know, that's why people spend careers doing that.
Yeah, philosophically, I want to talk about masturbating. One thing. Yeah.
the jobs.
Oh, so tell this me week, about this. Yeah.
Yeah, this week, and this is something that will resonate with you. This week I got some bad news from people, and by the way, it all came at once. And I was like, "Dude, I'm just gonna go. I gotta go to like my Thursday." I was like, "I gotta go to bed early because I can't. I don't know what's gonna happen next."
Can I stop news. You? For any time you internally say, "I've got to go to bed early because I can't take it anymore," that is a bad sign. I've been many times in that position. I'm just gonna go to bed at 8 right now. It's like I need
wasn't
oblivion.
Even tired. Yeah, yeah. I was like, I just gotta I need another day. I guess I'd say somebody who works with me for a long time, who I really admire and I really like working with, this person took another job.
Oh.
And then somebody who worked with me a short time, who I really like, I was just by chance praising this person and made a kind of a joke that, you know, there are two people in the room and if one of them had to get sick, you know, of course I hope neither one gets sick, but if one has to get sick, it better be this one because this person is really, really important. You know, I made a joke like that. Okay. And then this person's like, you know, I have to stop you. I feel so uncomfortable. I'm quitting the job. You know, I'm like, oh my God. And so it's like, yeah. One person quits, two people quit. And then I'm like, who? And then just, you know, and then a third person quit on me, quit something different. These are all different parts of my life. It's not like there's no pattern here. I tried to reflect, why is this happening?
It's you. Mostly, it's you.
I was like, why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to me? I was really struggling to understand why me, and what about me would, you know, what's going to happen to me after this? No, but I really tried to reflect, and I talked to these people and I really tried to get a sense. And one person told me something that will really resonate, which was, I really love this job, but ever since we came to Zoom, you know, it's a Zoom world. And by the way, you know, I'm a doc, you know, well, this person's job is more research-based, so it's not like, it is really, you know, for better or worse, it's Zoom-based. And, you know, a lot of the UCSF labs haven't even gone back in person and in my department, et cetera. So anyway, this person has been Zoom. And this person was like, you know, I really like it, but I'm switching jobs because I want a job where I can just go and sit there and talk to people about how their weekend was and then come home. And I was like, wow, you know, that's what they said.
Oh, man. This is the great resignation, the great quit. People, I think this has been a trigger where people are like, wait, what? You know what's crazy, though, Vinay? So how do you parse the idea that a lot of people who work at, say, Apple or Google, they throw a shit hissy fit when they're told they need to come back into the office so many days a week? Many of them quit, or they go basically effectively go on strike saying, no, this is not flexible. We work from home, et cetera. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Here's what I think. I don't know. And you tell me what you think. I think that they have a job that they actually do all the work in like 2 hours. And then the rest of the day, they just screw around. I mean, I think that, like, I don't know, maybe people aren't giving them more work to do. Maybe they're super efficient. I mean, and maybe 2 hours is the most we can really, really, really focus and work. But I'm sure that at home, this dude who works for Apple, he's like, dude, I'm done 10 to noon. Then I get lunch. I go for a walk. I walk my dog. I hang out at home. Whatever. I think they're like totally comfortable with that. And the thought of going to work and sitting there and looking at the clock and making sure your boss's cubicle isn't looking at your cubicle, like, that's a buzzkill. That's my thought.
No,
I don't know. Being a doctor is different because you gotta. I mean, if you're there, you're working, and if you're not there, you're not working.
That's right. Being a doctor is different. But I'll say, you know, like when I had my studio in Las Vegas, and me and Tom and Logan were there, and you know, we knew this fact about all three of us. We value autonomy. We're quite efficient when we're in our zone, and our zone was between 9 a.m. to about 1 p.m. That's when we're firing, right before they would eat lunch. And so we would just we're like, you know what, why do we need to stay here in the studio all day? Let's do our most productive work, and then we can get out, and if there's stuff that still needs to be done, we can do it from home. And it worked out well. But I'll say, you know, and again, I think each job is different, so there's no one-size answer for it, but I do think there is an importance to in-person interaction with your colleagues. Now, I'm not saying live in a cubicle doing nothing, twiddling your thumbs. I did a job like that fresh out of residency because I don't know if you know this. I when I finished my internal medicine residency, I was so just disillusioned. And I don't know if it was burned out, but it was really, I was just, I don't know that I can do this for my life. This is such
So you were a model for a few years.
I was a male model, the only country that would consider me male model material was Luxembourg. It was really strange.
There's a lot of watches.
I, the aesthetic, I have a Luxembourgian physique, apparently. I completely fabricated it. So I said, you know what? I got to explore what the Silicon Valley is about. So I went and worked for a couple different tech startups. Now, one of them was a work from home job where I created educational materials for an online site, and that is now since defunct. And so I was working from home with my wife, who had also graduated residency with me, but was going re-residencing in radiology, but we had a year off. And so working from home like that, the only person I ever saw was my wife. It was so weird that there was no separation between home and work. And it was so isolating that I hated it and ended up quitting. Then I went into the job where I had to go in every single day. There was no remote work. And I sat in a cubicle with other people who sat in cubicles for 8 hours. And I was like, this makes me want to basically
kill yourself.
Yeah, this is where I want liberal gun laws so I can come back with a weapon and shoot this. I'm kidding.
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
It's not even a good joke. It's not even a good joke. It is inappropriate. But I will say that's how I felt so dehumanized by that. So you've got to find a balance. There's got to be something that's appropriate for the work and the person, and there's got to be some customizability. So for me, you know, it's a mix of those things that I think is important, the flexibility and the in-person relational stuff.
I guess I have to admit that that's why I like medicine, because what's our work-life balance like? I mean, there are definitely days when you're in clinic, you got to be there. You got to get up and be there on time and do it, and you're there until a certain time. When you're on rounds, you have some flexibility when round starts, but you don't get to round from home. I mean, I know
some people do.
Yeah, you know.
It's not a good idea.
No. I disagree strongly. Everyone's like, not every visit has to be in person. Absolutely. There's certainly some visits that can be by telephone or by Zoom, but some visits have to be in person.
Yeah.
And taking care of somebody who's in the hospital, it has to be in person. I mean, come on. You need all your senses when you go in there. Anyway, so that's part of our job. Then research, very flexible, can be done on Zoom. We have Zoom meetings. I try to keep it engaging as it can be on that hellscape platform. and then a lot of travel. And as an academic, you know, we travel a lot, give lectures. And, you know, I found in the COVID, you know, when COVID hit, I was so grateful I had some travel. I didn't want to go. I was definitely traveling too much, but then I quickly realized what it's like to travel too little.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a sweet spot, right? So you get a blend of all the things in medicine. I don't know. I don't know why people want to work. I think the generation is different too. Like, I don't know. I mean, I have a job that is very different than a lot of people's jobs. And you have a job that's very different than a lot of people's jobs. And here's why it's different. 90% of what I do, I have chosen as my task for myself. Mm. You know, I have some clinics that are assigned to me and people tell me what to do for like clinical duties. But in my research, what are we studying? How much are we working on it? Where are we publishing? You know, working on Substack and YouTube and this podcast and all the things that I'm working on. That's you know, I picked it. I put that on my plate. And you're the same way. You're 100%, right? Everything you work on is what you choose to work. Nobody telling you what to do.
Yeah.
And that's very different than I think if we worked for a job where 100% of what we did was they told us to do it.
That's a huge point. Is there's these sort of three aspects to feeling real capable in your job: having tools like technology to do what you want, having teams like support, and you're talking about, you know, this real trauma of losing members of your team, right? It's a trauma. And then the thing you're pointing at now is the trust. So it's trust to do what you need to do, the latitude to have autonomy to do your job is key. And the fact that you choose what you're doing, this is why, I'll be honest with you. This is why I chose to be a hospitalist, because the job that I signed up for at Stanford was a job where you go in, you see the patients, you're done when you're done seeing the patients, you go home, you take phone calls, you get on Epic, you finish your charting from home maybe, if you get called, and if you're on call, you go in. So it was, you were never compelled really. You did it the way you wanted to do it. Now, clinic job, on the other hand, you're there from 9 until 6 until your charting's done, and it's scheduled, regimented, and there's nothing you can do about it. For me, that wasn't a fit. It would drive me crazy. So it's very personal too, I think.
Absolutely. I do a little bit of both, and I have to admit I like the inpatient scheduling better, because, you know, it's more in your control. And and then the other thing I like about inpatient, of course, is that you know where to find people, you know? And sometimes in clinic, somebody's like 50 minutes late, and you're like, oh. And my policy is, my policy is I will always see anybody as long as I'm still there.
Yeah.
I'm not one of these cut people off thing, because, you know, I know what it's like. You come in a long way, so, you know, I'm always going to see you as long as I'm still there. But it's going to be a rough last hour if everyone comes at once. You know,
yeah, and that's what always seems to happen.
It always, when it rains, it pours.
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, the whole idea of a black cloud and a white cloud, I talked about this with my friend John Kniff on the show, who was a hospitalist who hired me all way back in the day, kind of a mentor. And he basically, you know, we were talking about how the black cloud, white cloud, it isn't not a real thing, in the sense that it's not like you're luckier or whatever. It's that your attitude towards your circumstance is different. And when you're a white cloud, you just, you again, the glass is half full, and you're making, do with what you can. Where you're a black cloud, it's like everything is why is this happening to me? Like what you're saying, why is this happening to me? What is it that I don't deserve this and so on? And it's like, oh, that should thinking is actually a cognitive distortion. And, you know, looking at it differently can change it.
You mean the world doesn't revolve around us, Z?
You know what? I think Galileo and Copernicus were full of shit. Like, absolutely everything revolves around us. What else can it revolve around? Look at my head. Does it not look like a celestial body with a high gravitational attraction? Come on, dude. Tell me. In Luxembourg, like I'm a fucking star.
You're an underwear model. You forgot that.
Yeah, that's right.
You're Marky Mark in Luxembourg.
I'm Marky Mark in Luxembourg. Except in Luxembourg, they wear their underwear on their head. It's a strange cultural thing. I like to pick on a country I know nothing about. Speaking of something I know nothing about, I know a little bit about, but this monkeypox thing, dude. Okay, it's like it's almost, I know I'm gonna go there because
you gotta educate me. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, so this is what I understand about monkeypox. Here's an interesting side note that I think one of my best friends in the world, this guy Dr. Harry, he's been on the show a few times, pediatrician. We started Z-Dog kind of together and we did these music videos and stuff, and he's the guy who really got me into vaccine advocacy when I was young, because he would tell me, you know, there are a lot of people who don't vaccinate their kids because they're afraid it's going to cause autism and so on. And I'm like, well, is that true? And had to research it. And it's like, oh, it's not true. So anyways, his wife is also a physician, and her dad was a doc who was a microbiologist in Taiwan back in the day. And he wrote as his dissertation one of the seminal pieces in 1970 on monkeypox, because at that point it had first been described in humans, because it was discovered in 1958 in a colony of research monkeys. That's why it got the name monkeypox, even though monkeys weren't the primary.
Even though it's rodent pox, it should be rodent pox.
That's right, rat pox, son, or whatever, okay. Like, you know, ground squirrel pox, pouched rat pox. And so the idea that then it was endemic to Africa, it was a zoonotic infection with a reservoir in animals, so you were never going to eradicate it, but it required close contact with bodily fluids or, you know, rat juice, more or less, and that it could spread from human to human, but only with prolonged close contact between, again, fluids or respiratory droplets, so big pieces of mucus that are flying out of your mouth or spit and that getting into another person's mouth or eyes. And so difficult to transmit, but not unheard of. And the interesting twist is it turns out smallpox has a lot of homology. They're both orthopox viruses in that same family. And as a result, the smallpox vaccination, which is a vaccinia virus that triggers a local inflammatory response. I have the scar myself because I was vaccinated against smallpox, one of the last people to be so.
This is why you're not in fear of monkeypox, by the way. You've got some cross immunity. Look at you, gallivanting around, fearless.
You know, I got to say this, for the people who are listening audio only podcasts, they're not going to see this, but this is important. When monkeypox came up, I was like, hey, monkeypox, can you hear this? Let me turn it up for you. Okay. I don't care about you because I'm probably immune, maybe or maybe not. So the smallpox vaccination has some crossover immunity, about 85% in an observational trial. And so you didn't see a whole ton of monkeypox.
You got to cut back to you. You're looking at my beautiful
thank
face.
You. Thank you. There you go. You know what's great? I love this because you actually call me when I can't, because you can see it.
Because I can see it.
When I'm not clipping back and forth, whereas normally a guest can't tell me. There was immunity, but now that's all waning because we're no longer vaccinating. We stopped in like 72 in the United States and so on. So I actually got it in 73 when I was born because I went to India. My mom squirreled me away to India where I think they were still vaccinating. And so long story short, now we see a resurgence. It's actually been increasing in Africa and people have been kind of talking about it. There are a couple of vaccines against smallpox that still might be effective against it. There's also a treatment. That's T-Pox, the generic name for
T-Pox.
It. T-Pox, West Side, West Africa,
rapper name.
West Africa Side, right? That's a. Is that your? Is
that's
that
the T-Pox?
You look like a T-Pox.
Maybe I would be V-Pox.
Oh, vaccinia pox. I like that. Yeah. I like that. That's hot. Yeah. That's hot. In Luxembourg, it's hot. In America,
Luxembourg.
Yeah, you know. So
I always told you my podcast is more popular in Western Europe than the US. You know that, right?
You know, this makes perfect sense because the Western Europeans care about shit nobody cares about, like oncology and clinical trials.
They care about, like, let's all be careful and, like, use our resources for the stewardship of the community. And here we're like, make it rain with those canceled drugs, you know? I was like, come on.
T-Pox, make it rain. V-Pox.
Make it rain.
Make it rain. So, long story short, now we're in a situation where we're seeing non-endemic spread of monkeypox, a few hundred cases in places that you haven't heard about it. Originally in the males who have sex with male or men who have sex with men population.
Okay, let me ask you this question.
Yes.
This is the question that I got to ask you. 10 years ago, I think it would have been culturally very appropriate that every time they talk about monkeypox to acknowledge that the vast majority of cases to date are in men who have sex with men. Of course, in the modern world, I think it's maybe some people view that as politically incorrect to make that fact known. And they talk about how, you know, quote unquote, everyone is at risk of monkeypox, which is also true. You know, all people are at risk of monkeypox. That's not untrue. Yep. But they don't emphasize that fact that it is currently undergoing rampant transmission in the men who have sex with men community. So my question to you is political correctness getting in the way of accurate and informative public health messaging that actually targets people who really do need to take more precautions than other people?
Oh, 100%. I mean, it took me how long of researching through articles to find someone who would say that the outbreak currently is in a population of men who have sex with men and in these particular scenarios and so on. Now, why is that politically correct? Because you might stigmatize that population if you're a moron and prejudiced already and a dick. Yeah. But, you know, you would think society's grown up since the HIV epidemic. And instead, what that information tells us is, okay, so what are the highest risk groups that we can target for the most effective intervention? What also can we learn about transmission patterns? And how can we help prevent it from spreading wider? If we'd actually done that early on with HIV, like, those lessons have been taught, and yet we are not learning them. And as Monica Gandhi has said, because this is kind of her lane, she said, you know, but you don't tell people don't have sex. You say, here are the precautions, here are the things you look for when you're symptomatic.
I gotta say one thing about this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There is one person who is a public health scholar who had a long thread about how the right way to handle monkeypox is not to tell people not to have sex, to meet men where they are and suggest safer ways to do it and to be vigilant for the right signs and to do contact tracing and those sorts of things.
Yes.
But not to have this blanket. This is the same person who said we should lock down indefinitely, mask toddlers, you know? And I'm like, how can you not see it? On one issue, you're right, harm reduction. On the other issue, you just don't get it. Why? How did this happen to you?
Man, it's a cognitive dissonance. You know, it's the same thing. It's like, you know, when COVID first started, people were saying, you know, it's mostly elderly people with chronic disease who are at risk for dying. That's where we need to maybe focus our efforts. And then that evolved to, let's mask a two-year-old and shut down school. And it's like,
yeah,
wait, what?
Exactly.
So, say now with monkeypox, what is interesting is there is a twist now where they sequenced the genome or did something, and they saw about a really unusually high number of mutations in this monkeypox relative to whatever the Cameroon strain or whatever the original strain was. There are two strains actually that were classically looked at. There was a West African strain and a Congo River Basin strain, I believe. And the Congo Basin strain had a higher case fatality rate than the West African strain. So the question is, DNA virus, it's a double-stranded DNA virus. Those are typically less prone to mutations because the software in that DNA virus tends to be better at error correction than, say, an RNA virus like COVID. So the question is, why so many mutations? Or do those mutations have an impact on how it's transmitted? And is it going to become now endemic in humans to where it's transmitted from human to human and it's another problem that we have to deal with? So curious where you are in all this.
Obviously, you know, monkeypox mutations is a subject near and dear to my heart, and I'm always... I guess the first thought I have, and this is as somebody who has no knowledge of this, but my first thought would be, I would be immediately curious when somebody says, we have a sense of how many mutations should occur. I just want to know, you're making that claim based on sort of what sample size data. Are we talking about, you know, how many people and, you know, how much? I mean, because I suspect that for things you don't talk about that often, the uncertainty bounds are probably bigger than you say. So maybe this is actually more expected than you make it out to be. My only other thought about monkeypox is, I just noticed that the New York Department of Health, the moment they heard about monkeypox, they were like, and by the way, the best thing you can do to avoid monkeypox is wear a mask in public. I'm like, dude, you can't just hijack everything into your fucking mask. I mean, everything's got to be there. You got to wear the mask. That's how monkeypox is going around. Oh, in human history, the one time we're wearing the mask, that's when it has the outbreak, but it's the mask that will solve, of course.
You got testicle cancer? Were you not wearing your mask? What's
going
on? You're
not masked up. The best way to avoid, the testicle cancer is to mask up. I mean, is everything masked up? Shut up. Yeah, and of course, it was totally wrong.
You could see the corny, like, high school prom rap PSAs that they would write, you know, yo, mask your nuts if you don't want cancer. The whole thing is absolutely.
T-Pox!
T-Pox in the house? By the way, the one population of people I think we should stigmatize and really focus on in the monkeypox epidemic are MSM, men who have sex with monkeys. That is a problem.
Monkeys.
And you don't want that. By the way, Peter Gabriel had already called this so many years ago, right, with Shock the Monkey, which I never knew what it was about. Apparently, it was about when you're in a romantic relationship and you're triggered by something that triggers your kind of unconscious rage, you just shocked the monkey, which... Now I hate that song.
What?
Like, that's dumb, you know, right?
So I know the song, and I actually really like Peter Gabriel.
Me too.
Who I think is actually kind of a brilliant composer. In
oh,
his
he's
way.
A genius. Yeah.
But what is Shock the Monkey? I don't think I ever knew what it was. What does it mean?
I think if I read correctly, because I was Googling
oh,
this.
It's
after.
It's not a literal monkey. It's a metaphor for your feelings.
It's a metaphor okay. for your feelings. You know, don't you know you're gonna shock the monkey? And he's like, watch the monkey get hurt, monkey.
And have you heard, I mean, Sledgehammer, of course, one of my favorites.
Yeah,
and then
right.
I recently heard a video of Harry Styles singing Sledgehammer.
What?
And, you know... Oh, it's good, dude. He's actually a legit singer. It was good.
Dude, One
say.
Direction Harry Styles? No.
Yep. No, you watch, I swear to you, Google, YouTube this, Harry Styles singing Sledgehammer, and you will think differently of this guy. I'm like, oh, the dude can, he actually takes it seriously. He can sing.
That is awesome.
I mean, great song.
Gimme
Salisbury Steve. Hill.
Salisbury Hill, right. You know what,
beautiful.
Though? I'll say this. I am old enough to... appreciate Peter Gabriel's Genesis days when he was in Genesis with Phil Collins on drums, and then Phil
wow.
and then he left and Phil Collins took the vocal spot. But man, it was some crazy shit in those days, progressive rock and all that. Speaking of crazy,
you know, I got to tell you one funny story.
Yeah.
There's this dude Aaron Goodman, and I hope he doesn't mind me telling this story. I mean, he's a guitarist. He's in a band, man, and he jams. And you know, I've dabbled myself, as you know. You know, I used to play in college and beyond a little bit and write some songs.
Yeah.
And I know you play, you know. And he was telling me that recently he was at ASH conference and people were like, "Oh man, Aaron Goodman, can I get a photo with you? Can I get you to sign my ASH thing?" And he was like, "Whoa, what's going on?" And he was like, "Oh, did they heard of my band?" And then they're like, "No, man, I see you on Twitter and you got the best hematology tweetorial." And then I was like, oh no, can you imagine? He only wanted to be known for being a good guitarist, and he's known for the hematology tweetorial.
You know what?
God.
As someone who wanted to be a rock star when he grew up, I will take the fame where I can get it, okay? Hey, Z, I really like what you said about nurse violence. Yeah, thanks, man, thanks. Do you want an autograph? No, that's dumb, dude. Let's do a selfie. But like, you got to get taller. You can shut up right now. In Luxembourg, I'm considered 7 foot tall.
You know, I mean, I don't know. Anyone who dreamed of play, you know, being known for playing music, it's I'll tell you, Z, it's a letdown, man.
It is. It's a real letdown. It's a real letdown.
It's a real letdown, dude.
It's like fire up the prolactin because I am let down, dude. It's bad. Speaking of letdown.
They're like, I love your publication in the Mayo Clinic proceedings. They're like, oh, no, not Mayo Clinic proceedings.
It's not even penis. At least I could say, oh, I'm big in penis, you know.
Well, speaking of penis. They're publishing some pee shit.
Oh, there
I mean,
you
they
go.
They have a new piece of shit study, and they have two tracks. They have a track for members of the Academy and non-members of the Academy. And if you're a member of the Academy, you can get away with publishing garbage.
There it is.
Over and over.
So
yeah.
Speaking of garbage, the Amber Heard Johnny Depp trial, just to wrap this whole shit show up.
And I got 3 minutes. So
okay.
speaking of, before we shit the bed, okay, yeah. Let's get to this.
I think this was a referendum on popular opinion and credibility of a of a someone who's testifying, and Amber Heard. This is so difficult because, you know, you think about Me Too, you think about all allegations of violence and intimate violence and all of that, and then you make this the case study. It's really not good, because in many ways, look, I don't know who was right. All I know is Amber Heard was not a very compelling witness because of all the stuff that you see and how it's portrayed and all that. Johnny Depp is a better actor probably than Amber Heard. And I don't know, there's no truth telling here. Like, there's no figuring out what's actually true. And I only poked at this a little bit. But
so I have to be honest with you, I guess, I actually have no idea about anything in the trial, but I guess let me correct me if I'm wrong. My vague understanding is that he has filed a defamation suit against her because she wrote an op-ed that was actually drafted by the ACLU. And in the op-ed, it alleged that he had subjected her to domestic violence or domestic abuse.
Yes.
And he claimed he didn't. And there's somehow this whole court case was about whether or not by publishing that op-ed, she defamed his reputation.
That's right. And it cost him his Pirates of the Caribbean franchise and so on. So he was, a judge ruled in his favor and said, here's, you know, $10 million awarded by Amber Heard. But essentially there was a counterclaim by her about some libelous claim that he made that she actually won. And so she got $2 million back for that.
Again, these are... Eight in his direction, but
I forget the exact number, but it's something along those lines. And the truth is, they're both terrible people.
But then let me ask one question: like, if somebody, I mean, how does one even know what actually happened?
No, you can't, because they have a bunch of witnesses, and a lot of them are like fairly famous people, like Kate Moss and other people like that.
But if the witnesses weren't present, were they present or not present?
Not for the violence, but there was a big, long, circumstantial case, and you know that kind of thing. And honestly, I didn't watch much of it. All I saw were the memes. So I have no qualification to talk about this.
I know. I mean, all I saw was that one obviously very noteworthy line and a few memes. And then I saw like how he actually was dressing. And I was like, this is how the guy goes to court. I mean, what is he?
Dude, when you dress like D'Artagnan to show up to court, you know? It's like, what the hell is this?
But I didn't follow.
How does one even...
I'm still stuck on like, how can you even know what actually, two people are in a room and something happens and everyone has a different story, how do you even know what the truth is?
Once again, it's about culture and not truth. It's not about finding truth. It's about the culture. But that's a good way to wrap up because I know you got to go. Right. This was fun. I like doing it by Zoom. We'll see if anybody likes it. But either way, it's an audio podcast.
Threw me off.
It's a little weird, right? It's a little weird.
Your shiny head threw me off my game. No, just
at least you don't have to sit here pushing a button every time going back and forth like this. Giving people seizures, like, you know.
God. I'm always worried that you're going to catch me and, you know, I'll be like
picking
scratching
your nose.
That's
the thing, because when we usually do it, I'm like, well, I don't know, Vinay, the thing is, and then, you know, I'm like Al Bundy too. Often my hand will just reflexively go down my pants.
I used to love that show.
Me too. Love and Marriage. It goes together like a horse and carriage. All right. So we did a thing. Guys, you know what to do. Subscribe to the show. Leave a review. If you're watching on YouTube, leave your comments. If you're not, you can always reach me, hello@zdogmd.com, and yell at me on behalf of VP and me. VP, you had something
to say?
You
can reach me at my website, vinaykprasad.com, the contact me link. And follow me on Substack. That's where you can get the hot content.
Yeah. Follow VP on Substack. His Substack is hot because he's VPOX. What up, VPOX?
VPOX. I'm gonna rename that Substack. Yeah.
I like the VPOX letter. I like that. I don't know. And we're out. Thanks, VP. Peace.